Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore.
Good morning, Justice Moore. How are you today, sir?
Morning, Rich. Great wet, soggy morning, but
indeed.
Not too bad out there, actually.
Yeah. You know, the slush is inconvenient, but it's not as bad as you know, it could have been ice. So
yes,
it's all right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. How have you been the last month?
Well,
sir?
Good. We're a week late because of my venture to New York City. My daughter decided it would be fun. I put quotes around that, to run the New York City half marathon. So she put her name in the lottery for it and really didn't expect to be picked.
Yeah.
And got picked. There's 27,000 people that are,
wow.
I mean, it's an enormous
event.
It starts down in Brooklyn, down in Prospect Park, if you know that area, comes up, crosses the Manhattan Bridge, goes over to the East River, FDR Parkway, goes up to 42nd Street, west to Times Square, and then up to Central Park, and then around that way. And so
that's cool.
Yeah, it was fun. My oldest son and I were the support team. So we got my brother and his wife happened to be there too, coming back from an overseas trip. So we had a little family time, which was fun.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it was great. The weather was lovely. Only saw two disturbing people on the subway. The subway otherwise was fantastic. Tons of law enforcement. I mean, the mayor of New York City and the governor have really called out the gendarmes, as they say.
Yeah.
There's a lot of visible police presence everywhere, which was actually somewhat comforting, although there wasn't a lot of active stuff going on.
Right.
It's a little hard to know exactly what they were doing other than just being there, but that was great.
You know, I have been to New York City half a dozen times, and I've got a cousin even that lives in Brooklyn. I've never been to Brooklyn. I've been to every other borough. I've never been to Staten Island either. But
I'm not a New York City. I mean, I don't have a ton of experience there. But from what I gather, it's really an up and coming place.
Yeah.
That, I mean, the development around that Barclays Center, you know, where the Brooklyn Nets play. I mean, it's impressive, and the Prospect Park is actually quite nice. It was a good starting place for the race. Lots of open green space, and so yeah, she finished. Did pretty well. You get put in a corral with other people who are supposedly running at the pace that you claim. But what I saw was a lot of people were claiming to be running at paces that they weren't actually running, based on what I saw after the first 3 miles, where you saw some people walking.
Yeah.
But it was a bit of an endurance test. But we also happened to see the St. Patrick's Day parade on Saturday, which was fantastic. Although that thing is 6 hours. That is an endeavor.
Yeah.
It's right up Fifth Avenue. It is quite a deal. And we watched it from a couple of vantage points, but right outside St. Patrick's Cathedral, obviously.
That's cool.
Kind of ground zero for the parade, and lots of fife and drum bands, bagpipers, and then people representing different counties of Ireland, and lots of dignitaries and press.
I would think you'd be hearing bagpipes in your head for days after something like that.
Yeah, after about 90 minutes of it, I think we got the gist of how things were going, and so we kind of moved on. But it was great.
That's fantastic.
Lots of fun, lots of very celebratory feel, and you know, low 60s. I mean,
the
city was really lively and lots of activity.
I love to visit New York City, and I love to leave New York City after about 3 days.
Yeah, it's kind of exhausting.
Yeah,
I mean, we got to one musical. Never had seen Wicked. It was one of those bucket list ones.
Yeah,
and we were fortunate to get tickets. It was really a tough weekend for tickets. There was another show that I wanted to see that was completely sold out. My daughter and her college friends saw Chicago, the rebirth of that she said was excellent. So, yeah, saw a show, if you like bookstores, the Strand Bookstore in Greenwich Village is just unbelievable. It is next level of You know, I can't even describe it.
Bookstore in Greenwich Village. That's it. Say no more. I mean, that's all you have to say.
Yeah. I mean, we actually stayed in a hotel in the Greenwich Village area, and the kaleidoscope of people and activities in Greenwich Village is unbelievable.
I'm a big Lower East Side guy. I love Washington Square Park. There's a great record. Oh, I don't know if it's still there or not, but a great record store right
there's a bunch of them right around there.
Revolver Records. Just a shout out to my friends at Revolver Records. It's just a great place.
Yeah. The problem is you have to bring back what you purchase.
Exactly.
So yeah, it's fantastic. It's a great vibe, and lots to get down to the South Street Seaport Museum. My son wanted to see that. There's actually a sailing ship moored there that this museum obtained. It was one of the last iron-hulled three-masted sailing ships that was used prior to, really, it was about, I think at about the time after the Titanic sunk that this particular ship was put out of commission. But yeah, so you can actually tour the ship, you can see where the crew worked, and in this South Street area is just another whole development, right at the end of Manhattan, that's really fun. So it was, I agree with you. 3 or 4 days is fine for me. I'm good. I can, you know, come back later.
Now, have you had a chance to visit the 9/11 Museum?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a friend of mine and I were talking about making a trip out there in the next 2 or 3 months, and that's top of my list. I was at Ground Zero. I was Ground Zero about a year after the attacks. And I couldn't be there for more than about 20 minutes. I mean, the energy in that place just was like, we gotta get out of here. But I very much want to go visit that memorial, that museum.
It is, it's must see. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of things in that category in Manhattan, but the 9/11 memorial is incredibly moving.
Yeah.
And the way the docents move you through the process of seeing everything that came up to it, it's really sobering. And it's probably one of those things where you want to take 3 hours. You want to make sure you've got enough time on the agenda to fully embrace it.
Right.
But yeah, it is worthwhile. And you know, the thing is, there's such a long list of things to see in New York that you have to go back at some point. I mean, it has to happen. So,
and yeah, make sure you've got something happy to do after you go to the, go to the 9/11.
Yeah. Memorial. Right. Yeah. Have a fun place to head out. We hung out a little bit in the Strawberry Fields area of Central Park across from the Dakota,
That's great.
And they have there's buskers everywhere in Manhattan, but I think the Strawberry Fields buskers are people who are selected to be there. I don't think you just show up and put your guitar out.
I think you're right. And anyone who wants to sit down in that area and play a John Lennon song or a Beatles song, you better have some chops.
Yeah, yeah. And so there was a solo guitarist who there was very good, excellent. And it was beautiful sunny day, people just enjoying it, and took the kids over to the Dakota, of course. Yep. And you know, neither of them were they were born in the late 90s or mid to late 90s, and so you know what happened in December of 1980, a world away, but we walked over and showed them the area. And it's somber, but yet Strawberry Fields is positive and reflective of the life of John Lennon.
Indeed.
And, you know, the positive things he stood for, obviously. Absolutely. Complicated person.
Very complicated man.
Like lots of us, you know, artists. He was a little bit of a tortured artist.
Yes, he was.
But, when he passed away, that was, never forget that night.
No.
I remember, thinking of the 9/11 experience too. Yeah. Those moments where you know exactly where you are, you were, and what you remember.
Right. Well, I'm glad you were able to get away, because, we want our Supreme Court justices to be rested and able to do their jobs.
Yeah, rest, I don't know about that. It was a 22,000 step a day event, and you know, we had to be down in Brooklyn at 6:40 in the morning for that, so you can work your way back.
Yeah.
We did see a number, you know, the rat issues in the subway are always a source of commentary. Mm-hmm. And when you get in the subway, when it's really early and there are not a lot of people around, it's creepy. They come out and they're up on the deck and, you know, I just wanted to see my own pizza rat, you know.
Exactly. I don't, you know, I've seen some disturbing stuff in, like, some really disturbing stuff in New York City. One of the things I've seen, cockroaches the size of baseballs. Like that to me was that I've never seen the classic New York City rat, right? But I've seen the classic New York City cockroach, and that's
enough.
That's enough. Exactly.
But yeah, back to work. We had finished the March sitting, and so now we're in that middle period of time between sittings. So we start the April sitting on April 1st, Fool's Day, with actually one of our big cases for April. And so, yeah, we got 11 cases coming up, including a traveling oral argument at the U of M law. So we have an actual argument before first year law students.
Is that something you do like an annual thing?
Yeah. We had a case in March at St. Thomas, and you know, we generally offer it to all three law schools. I don't know if Mitchell Hamlin has one scheduled this year. I don't think they do, because the court is going to be going to Mora, Minnesota in May for a high school traveling oral argument. Mm-hmm. So we only do one of those per sitting. And the April sitting involves criminal restitution issue that's going to be argued before the law students at the U of M. So, it's a typical calendar, 8 petitions for review, mixture of civil and criminal cases, 1 first degree murder direct appeal, 1 first degree murder post-conviction appeal, and 1 attorney discipline case. And I think the most interesting case for listeners is on April 1st, the Minnesota Voters Alliance versus Hunt, Simon Schroeder, et cetera. This is the challenge to the 2023 statute restoring the right to vote for individuals with felony convictions.
Yeah.
Listeners will remember Schroeder v. Simon was the attack on the reinstatement statute, and we found that wasn't unconstitutional. The legislature changed the law now, and it basically now restores the right to vote for individuals with felony convictions when they're not incarcerated. And so there was a lawsuit in Anoka County challenging this law on a number of grounds, and we granted accelerated review on that because of the importance of having that issue resolved before the primary vote.
Now, I have to ask about this because haven't you, as a court, haven't you already ruled on this? You had ruled on the concept before the legislature passed that law.
Well, at that point in time, we ruled on the constitutionality of the statute that existed at that time in terms of what had to happen prior to a person getting their right to vote reinstated. And so the based upon that, the legislature changed the law as they have the ability to do, and now there's a different pathway for people getting their right to vote reinstated. And you know, this is obviously controversial in some circles and important, so I'm not going to say more about it other than April 1st at this Capitol courtroom. I'm sure we're going to have a good crowd of interested observers for that case.
Is this the kind of case? And I shouldn't even ask this question because I don't think you can answer this. But is this the kind of case that could go to the United States Supreme Court?
I can't answer that. I mean, I can't. I mean, there's 4 different claims here, and most of them are under Minnesota law, and so the U.S. Supreme Court isn't the last voice on the interpretation of the Minnesota Constitution.
Okay.
That's our court.
Yes.
To the extent that there are federal constitutional issues involved, I guess anything is possible. It depends on how the case is resolved. But I think my guess is that the answer will be no on that.
Okay.
That this is an issue of state law.
All right.
And then April 9th, another kind of interesting case for civil lawyers. We're going to decide whether the Supreme Court should formally recognize a claim for negligence in the selection of an independent contractor. We have never recognize that as a claim. So if you, you know, negligently select an independent contractor to do something and that independent contractor causes harm, should there be a claim for that? I mean, this person's not your employee,
right?
You know, but somebody that you contract with. And there are, as you might guess, lots of different arguments around that issue. And so that's on April 9th at
wow.
the Minnesota Courtroom 300.
There, I'm going to guess there are hundreds of general contractors, construction contractors in this state paying close attention to that case.
I would think so. I mean, yeah. It's a claim that's been recognized in other states or rejected in other states. And so this is a common law claim. And so, you know, the state Supreme Court has the authority to say what the law is mm-hmm. and to recognize new claims. And that claim does not currently exist in Minnesota law. We're being asked to add it to the litany of common law claims that exist. There are legal and policy reasons surrounding it, and it's going to be an interesting one. Let's
interesting.
Just say that.
Yeah,
much.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then I guess generally the other issue we're waiting for is the, you know, decision on who's going to replace our outgoing members. As listeners know, we have two members of the court that are leaving us. Justice G. Barry Anderson, his last day in the court will be May 10th. That's coming up faster than I even want to think about it. And then Margaret Chudich will be leaving at the end of the term on July 31st.
Right.
And so there's a lot going on right now regarding, you know, getting their cases wrapped up, changing administrative assignments mm-hmm. that are to them, to mm-hmm. others. But since we don't know who their replacements are going to be, we're in a little bit of a stasis. And so there has been a semi-finalist list created.
Oh.
That is not a public list.
Right.
That's the governor and the selection commission. But I know that they're doing interviews coming up here very soon. And out of that semi-final list will be a finalist list that will be public, that will be announced, and then those people will interview before the governor and the lieutenant governor, and a decision will be made, and I would expect it'll be sometime in April.
Sure. You know, it occurs to me, I never thought to ask this question, but has anyone ever turned down a seat on the state Supreme Court? Is that the kind of thing that would happen?
You know, I think those are things that are probably private conversations
yeah.
between people. I've certainly have heard of people turning down United States Supreme Court seats.
Yeah.
I mean, it was widely reported that Bill Clinton wanted to appoint Mario Cuomo to the Supreme
right.
Court
right.
a number of times,
right.
and apparently that he was not interested in that appointment. As the state Supreme Court, I would just be speculating that mm-hmm. there may have been circumstances where people were, you know, discussed as possible candidates
yeah.
and kind of took themselves
yeah.
out of consideration for
right.
various reasons. But the people who have applied, we had a pretty robust group of applicants from what I understand. Again, those are not public, but we hear through the grapevine and we
mm-hmm.
get calls on people.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of put the list together. So, yeah, we're looking with lots of anticipation to the announcement of new colleagues, and I would assume we'll get both colleagues announced at once with different start dates. That's kind of what I'm guessing.
Okay. All right, because I was wondering about the governor doesn't have to do that. He can announce one and then go through the process again and announce another.
Well, the process is a dual process, but the governor certainly would have the authority to announce Justice Anderson's replacement mm-hmm. first and then come back and announce Chudich's at a later date.
Right.
Yeah, that would be totally fine.
As I recall, the newest justice, whose name escapes me.
Procaccini.
Yeah, Justice Procaccini was announced. It was like days before that seat was about to open. Well, I mean, there was not a lot of time in between his announcement and when he took the bench.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was announced at the same time as the Chief Justice appointment was.
Yes.
And your memory is accurate. The announcement was made sometime, August, I
yeah.
think, and they started the first day of
September
of October.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what it was. He wasn't there in the September calendar, so the transition took place
yeah.
for the calendar starting October 1.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's going to happen fast. I mean, when I got the call from the governor, it was on or about the 15th of May, and he wanted me to be there at the start of the court term in August.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's 2.5 months. I'm a little nervous if there's an announcement made in April and you're expecting somebody to start, you know, on May 13th, which would be the Monday after Justice Anderson's retirement. That's a very tight time frame.
Okay.
And might have, you know, potentially be a challenge to obtain. But, you know, we'll see. Those are discussions that are happening behind the scenes. But one way or the other, we're going to find out soon.
Yeah.
And this will be very impactful to the court.
This
is going to be major. You know, you don't have three new colleagues in a year and not have some effects on the court. And so what, obviously my concern is for the court as an institution,
mm-hmm.
how it functions, how it's perceived in the public, how effective it is, how much trust and confidence people have in it,
mm-hmm.
Not only justice partners, but other judges, other, you know, courtroom litigants, lawyers, and the public. We are elected officials after being appointed, and so we govern with the consent of the electorate, govern in the sense of the judicial branch. It's very important that we maintain the public's trust and confidence.
100%.
And we cannot do anything to create cracks or fissures in
right.
that. And I, the collegiality of the court is essential to its functionality.
Yep.
And, you know, it's kind of an arranged marriage, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to sit down at a table with six other people that you may or may not know well, you may or may not agree with on some things, and you've got to be able to put aside some of your own feelings and agenda at times and work towards compromise and consensus. And so you need people that can do that, that don't come to the court with strongly held and, you know, views that are so ideologically, set that they can't move off them.
Yeah.
It's not to say you give up your strongly held views on things, but, you know, you sort of got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, sort of thing. I mean, that's
right.
kind of what it is. I mean, we don't have the time or the energy to have separate opinions on every case. We shouldn't. We should be able to come to consensus on 3/4 or more of our mm-hmm. cases, and we traditionally have.
That's good.
And that is important because a jumble of opinions doesn't help the system.
So you don't expect any kind of a left field selection then for either of these?
Well, I think the people who are in the commission's process right now are all people who have been vetted. Some of them I know personally,
sure.
and I know they've been there before.
Mm-hmm.
But technically the governor doesn't have to select from that process.
Yeah,
I think the fact that he's using it is wonderful. I think that's great. I've strongly advised the governor's office. I thought that would be a good thing this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's just a good, excellent thing that process
right.
is going forward. But ultimately, this is the governor's selection.
Absolutely. It is. You've always told me that one different person on the court, that's a whole new court. Three people within a year, that's, that's a dramatic change. Even if, the general outlook of these justices sort of matches who they stepped in for.
Right.
It's still a dramatic change. I mean, very much so. People are unique. So,
it is. You. It's like, imagine bringing a new member to your family.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a daughter-in-law right. or a son-in-law that shows up at the
right.
dinner table, and
right.
you know their views on things, trying to figure out, you know, sort of how they roll on mm-hmm. things, you know, how what their personality's like, how they decide things. That's a process. And it's a new court and with three new members. And again, we're talking about a collective amount of Supreme Court experience approaching, maybe exceeding 40 years if you include Lori Gilday's mm-hmm. time on the court,
mm-hmm.
Barry Anderson's and Margaret Shudich's.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a long haul. That's a lot of institutional knowledge.
It is.
And wisdom and judgment. And that's what, you know, that's really the important things. It's one thing to be a student of the law and to go research the law and you know, you can be a great writer, you can be thoughtful and smart, mm-hmm. but judgment and discretion
and adjudicator
are yeah. so important. You know, the tone of the decision, the how much you say, when you say it, why you say it. You know, there's reasons to say as little as possible sometimes.
Is there, you know what, I'm not going to ask the question because it will take us off. There's other stuff I want to get to, but I'm looking forward to talking about this again next month because it just leads to more kind of questions.
I don't know if we'll have choices by next month. We could. I mean, it depends. Certainly by May we will, but I'm guessing we might by next month, the next show. Yeah. And I know, Rich, you know, there's a lot of, I get questions all the time about, you know, who's likely to get picked and who, you know, and I that's not, obviously it's not my call.
Yep.
Do I have opinions? Sure. Mm-hmm. Do I have personal thoughts on this? Yes. Do I have my own biases?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I lean towards judges. I lean towards district court judges. That kind of experience I can relate to very well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also know that the court functions best with a diversity of life experiences. Frankly, ideological mm-hmm. perspectives and just, you know, work and learned experience.
Yeah.
And, you know, putting those things together, hopefully the alchemy of that brings forward decisions that are thoughtful and consider the ramifications on all sides. I am one that's very concerned about the practical implications of decisions.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not a, you know, I don't look at things just, you know, for instance, kind of in the law professor mindset. I mean, there's an aspect of our work that is very much academic, and you know, you have to synergize and understand complex legal theories and case law. But you also have to realize how these decisions affect people in our system and the people who work in our system, judges, prosecutors, public defenders, probation agents. I mean, you know, chemical use and evaluators. There's a lot of ways that our decisions have effects on people. And we've got to be mindful of that.
Yeah.
We can't just be deciding cases in the ether. I mean, that just doesn't work. We have to be thinking about what is actually going to be happening if we decide this way.
That's a really interesting statement to hear from a Supreme Court justice, because I have always sort of from a way outside looking in, I don't know the law, but it's always been, I've always thought that you guys would look at a case and base your decisions on how it relates specifically to a law that is brought to you. Like specifically, you know, that your parameters sometimes are about an inch wide on either way, but maybe that's not necessarily the case with everything you have to decide on.
Well, it depends. Obviously, we are there to decide the case in front of us. We're mm-hmm. not there to render advisory opinions or to go out on you know, sort of academic, you know, quests to determine, you know, the meaning of the Holy Grail or something. I mean, we're not, I mean, that's, we try to avoid wandering around in the wilderness, you know, looking for nuggets of wisdom. We are talking about discrete cases and controversies and usually a statute or a legal issue that is involving it. But in deciding that issue, sometimes statutes are not 100% clear. They can be ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And so when we interpret the meaning of statutes that are ambiguous, meaning there are reasonable alternative interpretations of on how a law should be viewed, one of the things the legislature has told us to do is to consider a number of things that
okay.
are called canons, things that we should be thinking about, and the, you know, the mischief to be remedied by a law, the practical effects of it. I mean, these are things that come into play when you have an ambiguous or questionably ambiguous statute. And so, you know, obviously we're trying to interpret what the legislature meant. We're not there to be a super legislature. We are there to interpret law. But we can't be blind to the effect of our decisions on the practical functioning of courts and litigants. I mean, we try to be as clear as we can about what our rules of law are, and, you know, whether or not people agree 100% with them, they at least know what they are and can understand them and can apply them. And they're not left kind of to scratch their heads as to what the rule is on a particular area. We could have a small, law school course on methods of statutory interpretation, mm-hmm. and different judicial philosophies, mm-hmm. on this issue. You know, is it an exercise of pulling a dictionary off a wall and just, you know, looking at a word and saying, well, that's what the word means.
Right.
And, you know, that's called textualism. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just going to stick strictly to the text and we're not going to look more broadly at that. And that's, you know, part of this discussion that's been going on with the U.S. Supreme Court,
yep.
for many years.
Yeah.
Many years. There are many conservatives that thought that the Warren Court was far too willing to read stuff into statutes that didn't exist,
right.
in an effort to, you know, accomplish results that they thought were good,
right.
for policy reasons. And
I know that Justice Scalia was a textualist.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And actually, Justice Kagan said recently, and I may be misquoting her, but I think I'm quoting her correctly, and I think this was done with a little bit of irony, but she said, we're all textualists now. I mean, I think the movements, I know our court, you reviewed the Minnesota Supreme Court decisions from the 70s and 80s,
mm-hmm.
compared to the last,
right.
15 years. There's a marked change in the analytical ways that courts are looking at statutes and the meaning of constitutional provisions.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's a maybe one for another day.
Rich. It is.
That's a good one.
That's a really good. But I really appreciate your. I mean, to me, it adds a little bit of humanity to the court, which I appreciate.
Well, so. when you've been in the trenches, as I like to say, when you've been in district court, when you've been a lawyer in district court, you've been a judge, you see the practical effect of cases on people, and this is, you know. We deal with some really hard, challenging,
mm-hmm.
problems.
Yeah.
And they are, you know, our district court colleagues have to look people in the eye, face to face in the courtroom, and deal with those issues. We see them more two-dimensionally or maybe one-dimensionally on a piece of paper. But we can't forget about the practical implications of a decision that we make. To ignore that, to me, seems to be just, you know, avoiding the obvious, which I just can't, I can't deal with. So I guess I'm probably in the David Souter, Stephen Breyer camp in terms of, you know, the way that, you know, the law gets looked at. I mean, we have to think about the fact that what we're doing, every case is affecting somebody, somebody's rights, somebody's liberty, somebody's, you know, pursuit of a business. So there's something happening that we can't be oblivious to. And that doesn't mean that we, you know, wander in the wilderness in the pursuit of some sort of a result that we think is just at the expense of ignoring what the legislature said or anything like that. But we have to be thoughtful. We do have to be thoughtful about that.
That's great. Now, I have to ask you, how are you set for time? Because I had something else I wanted to talk about. That we can keep it until next month. But
I think we should keep it. There's three Supreme Court cases that I think are worth discussing.
Okay.
And, you know, the Moody versus NetChoice is the Supreme Court case involving Texas and Florida laws that would regulate how large social media companies,
yep.
control content posted on their sites.
Yep.
Fascinating.
Yep.
Fascinating,
yep.
stuff. And you texted me last night that there was a 60 Minutes,
yes.
segment that got into that.
Yes.
Which I think I unfortunately was watching basketball, and I should have been focusing on the
show. You're watching a good game, though, so it's okay.
It was. I think we should hold that one in our back pockets,
okay.
And maybe devote some more time to
all
that,
right.
because that's going to require more than we've got. There were a couple of other really fascinating First Amendment arguments. The Murphy versus Missouri, the question is whether the government's ability to communicate with social media companies about their content moderation policies,
mm-hmm.
does that violate the First Amendment? The Fifth Circuit, I should say, in New Orleans said it did. The lawsuit came out of the efforts of the Biden administration to encourage companies to restrict misinformation about COVID-19,
mm-hmm.
the COVID-19 vaccine,
mm-hmm.
in 2021. And so the challengers to that law, two states of Republican attorneys general, Missouri and Louisiana, and other individuals whose social media posts were removed or downgraded, say the government's efforts violate social media users' right to free speech.
Mm-hmm.
So again, how much, you know, how much free speech do you have in a social media context?
As a journalist, of course, I'm very interested in free speech legislation like that. We're going to keep this until April because it is, I suspect if we got into it right now, we'd be talking for another 45 minutes.
Easily.
Okay.
It's, yes. And then there's the Gonzalez versus Texas, the case of a Texas city council member who contends she was arrested in retaliation for her criticism of the city's manager, which was a, real tough issue. First Hispanic woman elected to a city council in a city in Texas. She placed a petition that had been initiated criticizing the city's manager in her binder at the end of a long meeting. She said she picked it up accidentally, but then was charged with violating a state law later that prohibits tampering with government records. And this woman was arrested and spent a day in jail. She wasn't charged, but she filed a civil rights claim against the mayor, police chief, and lawyer who investigated her, saying that she was arrested in retaliation for a criticism of the city's manager. And so it's, you know, how the law, again, it's the First Amendment here in terms of one's ability to, you know, petition your government for redress of grievances and things such as that. These are really incredibly important, challenging questions. And I really admire the U.S. Supreme Court. They have a plate full right now of these decisions that are just, I mean, we could talk about the Mifepristone case that's coming up. I mean, there's, you know, the question of, you know, does Texas get to create its own immigration laws? And obviously then the most important case maybe that the Supreme Court has held in a long time, and the question of immunity, presidential immunity, which is a huge issue.
That's going to be the repercussions of that decision one way or the other are going to be so far reaching.
Yeah.
That it's okay. Well, Justice Moore, thank you. And folks, there's your preview for our show in April. If I'm doing my St. Olaf math right, that'll be on April 15th, Monday, April 15th.
St. Olaf math, but Rich, you were a poli-sci major.
Yeah, it's true.
Okay, let's look
22nd?
Here. You're correct.
First, Bingo, 15th. 15th. There we go. Yes.
April 15th, 9 a.m., be there.
Be there. And thanks again, Gordon. It's really good to see you.
Great to see you too.
Folks, we'll be back again next month on Legal Talk.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.